This is show 168, part 10. I say a resource, so you say divide and rule. We say holistic. Secret Affairs, Britain's Collusion with Radical Islam, Mark Curtis, Serpent's Tail Press, 2010, 2012 printing. Fascinating book. Looks like, I'm guessing 12, 13 parts total. Few chapters left. And already got some summary notes of things I learned from this book. So I think I'll save that for the last of the series. And I'll jump right into chapter 16, which is very much an eye-opener to me. Londonistan, a green light, in quotes, a green light to terrorism. And this is coming on the heels of the connections with the Balkans and the connections with 9/11, which again showing the kind of the historical pathway, so to speak, of all this stuff connecting that clearly shows that 9/11 was not some freak thing out of the blue. Although I do remember, impossible to forget the clear blue sky of that day, but the history shows this book is showing how much led up to that, and how much the enemy of the enemy of the friend of the friend of the however you riff that, how that just keeps changing and shifting depending on what's going on. So anyway, let's see, into the chapter. London in the 1990s was one of the world's major centers for radical Islamic groups organizing terrorism abroad. Yeah, a lot of times I'm reading this book, I do the cartoon shake of the head. London in the 1990s was one of the world's major centers for radical Islam groups organizing terrorism abroad. Organizations such as Algeria's Armed Islamic Group, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Egyptian Islamic Jihad, and Al-Qaeda itself, through its office, the Advice and Reformation Committee, all established bases in London. Al-Qaeda considered London to be the nerve center of its operations in Europe, and many of bin Laden's top lieutenants operated from there. Millions of pounds were raised in Britain to fund terrorist causes and recruit militants to fight across the globe, from Afghanistan to Yemen. Thousands of British-based individuals passed through Al-Qaeda training camps in the 90s. By the time of the July 2005 London bombings, the number was around 3,000, according to Lord Stevens, former Metropolitan Police Chief. The Home Office's official inquiry into the bombings would later disingenuously state, during the 90s, it is now known that there was a flow of young Muslims from the UK and elsewhere traveling to Pakistan and Afghanistan for indoctrination or jihad. In fact, this was known at the time and not only tolerated, but may have been actively championed by the British authorities, as we have seen with the participation of British jihadists in the Bosnia and Kosovo wars. A key feature of Londonistan was the operation of a so-called covenant of security between radical Islamists in Britain and the security services. Crispin Black, a former Cabinet Office intelligence analyst, described the covenant as the long-standing British habit of providing refuge and welfare to Islamist extremists on the unspoken assumption that if we give them a safe haven here, they will not attack us on these shores. A special branch officer said that there was a deal with these guys. We told them that if you don't cause us any problems, then we won't bother you. Ah, that's just sounds like right out of a movie. It was a deal with these guys. We told them if you don't cause us any problems, then we won't bother you. And it goes on again, layers of this stuff where they think there's a turning point, but it sort of is. Curtis says, however, the covenant of security did not simply die with 9/11. For one thing, and then he goes on to explain how various factions and people still activity going on. And here's a statement by Al-Mujaharun, that's a group or a person, I'm not sure, which explicitly mentioned the covenant and the dangers it faced. This is October 2001. For the moment, Muslims in the UK have a covenant of security which prevents them from attacking the lives and wealth of anyone here. However, The Blair regime is today sitting on a box of dynamite and have only themselves to blame if after attacking the Islamic movements and the Islamic scholars, it all blows up in their face. Following month, the government introduced new legislation in the Terrorism Act. Several organizations were declared illegal and banks were empowered to freeze the assets and accounts of organizations suspected of terrorism. In the 3 years after 9/11, 700 suspects were taken into British custody under the anti-terrorism law, though only 17 had been convicted by mid-2005. There's also, at some points, there's so many factions that even a statement of, you know, cracking down on terrorism can be a half-truth because there's so many offshoots and factions. All through this book I've been saying M16, but now I see more clearly it's MI6, or here they mention MI5. Had MI5 decided to act against these overseas activities, it is possible that 7/7 could have been prevented. Indeed, it was as much the militants themselves who tore up the covenant of security, especially after the invasion of Iraq in 2003, when Britain became even more of a target for their operations. The key question is why the British authorities allowed the phenomenon of Londonistan to develop and be sustained. My view is that one reason is directly linked to the theme of the book, that collusion with radical Islamists was seen as having advantages for the promotion of British foreign policy, a continuation of the role that these groups had regularly played for Britain in the post-war world. Closely linked to this was the fact that the British security services saw the covenant as encouraging certain individuals to act as informants on the activities of Islamist groups, which would be useful in monitoring them. Thus, they were protected from prosecution as they engaged in terrorism abroad. Yeah, such a mind clusterfuck, this stuff. I'm already looking forward to getting into my next book of whatever I'm going to be reading. Maybe something like, you know, Butterflies and Moonbeams after this book, which is not a put down on the book. It's just the it's a wonderful, informative book, eye opening. But just the amount of shenanigans is as I have said before, mind boggling. And there's a section called British Agents with a question mark. Skipping around, in this view, these groups are a useful tool, even a bargaining chip for the British elite to increase its influence over or put pressure on Arab states. That similar thing. And then here's a section on the ongoing divide and rule, divide and conquer. I saw a mention of Evo Morales calling it divide and reign, so R-E-I-G-N. British support of Islamist forces has often aimed to foment unrest both within and between states. The policy of domestic divide and rule to maintain colonial power has been seen in, for example, the encouragement of Muslims against Hindu nationalists in India and of Arabs or Jews against the other in Palestine under the British mandate. However, British policies have often gone further than nurturing tensions between communities and have sometimes involved attempts to break up states. A strategy of balkanization. The clearest example is the Soviet Union, where Britain sought to promote unrest in the Muslim republics by supporting the Basmachi rebellion in the 1920s and the various Mujahideen wars in the 1980s and 90s. The covert operations in Indonesia in the late 50s and in Kosovo in the late 90s also sought to balkanize states. It is not that balkanization has always been pursued by Britain. Whitehall's interest in breaking up states depends on who controls them, and if they are ruled by dependable allies, London will tend to favor strong central control. And here I have highlighted over and over and over again one of the book's theses. The overriding reason for keeping the Middle East divided has been to ensure that no single power dominates the region's oil resources, and so that a strong combination of powers cannot challenge Western hegemony. Well, that no single power dominates except for the single power dominating, which is, you know. Anyhow, let's see, a little farther down here. That's the way they say stuff. It's like so often, you know, it's the, they say exactly what they're doing. It's phenomenal. And a little farther down, again, another, long blah, blah. Selling arms to both sides in conflicts, a long-standing British policy, is certainly likely to keep tensions going between states. And this section goes into other British agents. And here's a section on some guy named Hassane, H-A-S-S-A-I-N-E. Hassane worked for MI5 gathering information on Abu Hamza. He later recalled how I told them, M15, Hamza was brainwashing people and sending them to Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps in Afghanistan, that he was preaching jihad and murder, and that he was involved in the provision of false passports. I told them he was a chief terrorist. However, Hussein's MI5 handler did not appear unduly worried. A stream of would-be jihadists continued to visit the mosque to hear Hamza preach, including Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, and Mohammed Sadiq Khan, the 7-7 bomber, who went there in 2002. And here's a bit that I have a note, highly suspicious, if inconclusive. However, even then, Hamza got off very lightly. The U.S. authorities wanted to put him on trial for recruiting, financing, and directing terrorism, but British prosecutors had accused Hamza of much lesser offenses, so the trial did not even probe his alleged connections to terrorist groups. And yet another factor is, you know, even some of the courts and agreements things where certain information, because it's so intertangled, the information, they're going to do whatever they can to not let that information get out, is another theme mentioned in this book. You know, some guy named Qatada, Qatada, while Qatada appeared to pose as being able to prevent terrorist attacks and expose dangerous militants, all along he continued activities in support of extremists, which was surely known to MI5. And here's a longer section I'll read. Time magazine reported senior European intelligence officials saying that Abu Qatada is tucked away in a safe house in the north of England, where he and his family are being lodged, fed, and clothed by British intelligence services. The sources say that the deal is that Abu Qatada is deprived of contact with extremists in London and Europe, but can't be arrested or expelled because no one officially knows where he is. The British win because the last thing they want is a hot potato they can't extradite for fear of Al-Qaeda reprisals, but whose presence contradicts London's support of the war on terror. Qatada was finally, quote, found in October 2002 after releasing a 10-page document justifying the 9/11 attacks. He was detained by the British authorities a few days later on suspicion of undertaking a range of support activities, including fundraising on behalf of various international terrorist organizations, and of making public statements of support for the violent activities of these groups. Qatada was subsequently held without charge in Belmarsh High Security Prison until being released subject to a control order in March 2005, when the law lords struck down an emergency anti-terror law that allowed his indefinite detention without trial. However, the authorities detained him again 5 months later, soon after Britain signed an extradition agreement with Jordan. But Qatada was again released from prison in June 2008, subject to strict bail conditions and a 22-hour curfew, after the High Court upheld his appeal against deportation to Jordan on the grounds that he was likely to face a terrorism trial based on evidence from witnesses who had been tortured. In February 2009, however, the law lords ruled that Qatada could be deported to Jordan since when he has been fighting extradition from prison in Britain. And later on, let's see, a memo written by an FBI agent just prior to 9/11 also noted a connection between Bakri and several suspects attending U.S. flight training schools, including one that was used by one of the hijackers. Yeah, that gets into some of the info that they already knew. Most intriguingly, after the 2005 London bombings, Bakri was not even interrogated by the security services as a possible suspect. Instead, he was allowed to leave the country. A month after 7/7, Bakri voluntarily left Britain for Lebanon, and a year later, in July 2006, the Home Secretary Charles Clarke announced that Bakri would not be permitted to return to Britain since his presence is not conducive to the public good. These decisions raise further suspicions about Whitehall's relationship with Bakri, given the jihadist activities he had been involved in, and also the well-publicized connections between the 7/7 bombers and other would-be British bombers in the Al-Mujahiroun organization. Farther on, by the time Bakri traveled to Lebanon, Al-Mujahiroun had formed 81 separate front organizations in 6 countries, according to New York police investigation, and had 600 to 1,500 members in Britain. It would have perhaps been rather useful for the security services to have questioned Bakri about his connections. Perhaps the British offered the same deal to Bakri as to Katada, to leave the country and escape being brought to trial, given what this might reveal about his relationship to the intelligence services. Interesting thing there, because I remember post 9/11 and, you know, hearing about stuff in New York City. I mean, at the same time that you could see how much mixed information, which really makes the whole global war on terror, why I call it the global war of terror, suspect. But then again, you have people trying to do their jobs and say, you know, say a New York police, however they, you know, look at the data and try to figure out what is just talk and what is, you know, an actual threat. And there they're mentioning, you know, 81 organizations and all kinds of stuff, and the amount of communications going on. It's, you know, I have compassion for those people in the sense of it's a tough call when to decide what may be terror or what not. That reminds of what's that guy, the Russian guy, I think, if I remember correctly, his name Petrov. There's some holiday after him that there was a I think it had to do with nuclear stuff, where he saw something on the chart and he had to make a decision, and he turned out to make the wise decision, assuming it was a false, and, you know, virtually saved the world, or literally saved the world. So that's another angle to throw in the hopper, and realizing that, you know, there are people that at whatever level may be dealing with this information, and how much they're in on it or not, I don't know, but something to realize. So wrapping up this chapter, in conclusion, it is possible that the Covenant of Security deterred Islamist attacks from occurring in Britain in the 90s, but at the huge cost of the green light to terrorism overseas. In the years after 9/11, however, both before and after the invasion of Iraq, a number of bomb plots in Britain began to be planned. The recruitment of Islamic radicals may have produced some intelligence on their overseas activities, but it is impossible to judge how useful this was or how much the British authorities tipped off their foreign counterparts. It is possible that the security services were just naive in believing that their informants could control the hotheads. But it is also possible that parts of the British security establishment were motivated not only by gaining information and restraining extremists, but also by the perceived advantages to British foreign policy of hosting these individuals in London. This assertion is not proven, since further evidence is lacking, but is consistent with Britain's long-standing use of Islamists for foreign policy purposes. British policies had clearly become downright dangerous to the British and world public. Chapter 17, 7-7, as in the July 7th, and the London-Islamabad Axis. After 9/11, Pakistan appeared to withdraw its support for the Taliban in Afghanistan and instead backed the Anglo-American War, which destroyed the regime along with the Al-Qaeda bases in the country. General Pervez Musharraf's military regime, which had taken power in a coup in October 1999, was now seen in London and Washington as the front line in the war on terror. British leaders proceeded to shower praise on Musharraf for his strong position on international terrorism and for being a staunch ally and key partner. The Blair government's backing of Pakistan in the face of the Taliban enemy recalled the Thatcher government's alliance with another Pakistani military ruler, General Zia-ul-Haq, in their covert war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Both Blair and Thatcher accepted at face value Zia's and Musharraf's pledges to return Pakistan to democracy, while they merely kept themselves in power. And both Blair and Thatcher saw the Pakistani military rulers as pro-Western forces of stability in their region, claiming they were the opponents of terrorism. The reality was that Musharraf's regime, which lasted until the general finally resigned in August 2008 under threat of impeachment, largely empowered the radical Islamic forces in Pakistan while undermining the secular nationalist parties, a repeat of Zia's rule. Although the regime tried to fight foreign al-Qaeda militants in the Pakistan-Afghanistan border areas at U.S. behest, it backed or tolerated the domestic Pakistani terrorist groups in order to promote Islamabad's long-standing goal of liberating Indian Kashmir. Neither did Musharraf really end Pakistan's support for the Taliban, as we see later. London's backing of Musharraf showed again how Whitehall was prepared in the post-9/11 world to collude with forces promoting radical Islam. Britain's Pakistan's policy had severe consequences, contributing to the London bombings in July 2005 and to the threat of terrorism currently faced by Britain. And another case of arming both sides. In the 8 months up to May 2002, Britain issued 125 arms export licenses to Pakistan while approving nearly 500 to India. And again, the real enemies to them are the liberal secular nationalist parties. See, various parties, their rise, these parties in 2002 owed much to Musharraf's attempt to delegitimize the more popular liberal parties, such as the Pakistan People's Party, PPP, led by Benazir Bhutto before her assassination in December 2007, and the Pakistan Muslim League, PML, led by Nawaz Sharif. Both Bhutto and Sharif were personally blocked from contesting the 2002 elections, and their parties portrayed by the regime as corrupt and incompetent to run the affairs of the country, paving the way for the religious parties. The PPP and PML were and are far from angelic, having been widely accused of corruption and having presided over Pakistan's surge into Central Asia in the early 1990s. Indeed, Pakistan's initial patronage of the Taliban in 1994 to 96 occurred under Bhutto's rule. Yet these parties command the overwhelming share of the Pakistani popular vote. As Human Rights Watch pointed out in 2007, radical Islam would not win the day if Musharraf were coaxed into retirement, since Islamists have never polled more than 12% of the vote in the national elections. So again, as with Iraq, where Hussein was, you know, not angelic, but the going in and messing in someone else's business, you know, like a Pandora's box thing. And interesting, Human Rights Watch there recently been sort of on this list of, you know, mixed baggery of reporting, doing the bidding of the empires at times, as far as, you know, promoting truths and stuff. I think that was in reference to Syria. And a little further on, far from confronting the Islamists, the International Crisis Group noted in an April 2005 report that in Pakistan's history, the mullahs have never been as powerful as now, and that instead of empowering liberal democratic voices, the government has co-opted the religious right and continues to rely on it to counter civilian opposition. By depriving democratic forces of an even playing field and continuing to ignore the need for state policies that would encourage and indeed reflect the country's religious diversity, the government has allowed religious extremist organizations and jihadi groups to flourish. Musharraf's priority, like General Zia's in the 1980s, was to consolidate his own grip on power, and to do so, he played a double game when it came to dealing with the Pakistani terrorist groups. In January 2002, for example, Musharraf delivered a major speech pledging to clamp down on terrorism and saying that Kashmir should now be considered a bilateral issue between Pakistan and India, thus appearing to sideline the Pakistani jihadists fighting there. This stance, together with public support for the U.S. war on terror, was enough to make the regime a direct target of the Pakistani jihadists. Yet 3 years later, the jihadist media was still flourishing, while leaders of ostensibly banned groups such as the Lashkar-e-Toiba and Jaish-e-Mohammed appeared to enjoy virtual immunity from the law and were free to preach their jihadist ideologies. The LET, Pakistan's best organized and most powerful militant organization, was proscribed by Musharraf in 2002, but no step has ever been taken to dismantle or even disarm it. And a little further on in this chapter, the London bombings. The four coordinated London bombings constituted the worst single terrorist activity in Britain, killing 52 people and injuring 700. They were the first successful Islamist terrorist attacks in the country and were conducted by four British-born Muslims, three of them of Pakistani origin living in Yorkshire, one of Jamaican origin living in Buckinghamshire. The bombings came 2 years after the invasion of Iraq and followed concerns voiced by some security officials that the country was likely to be attacked by homegrown terrorists. That the invasion of Iraq in March 2003 would inspire British Islamists to target Britain was recognized by British planners. 3 months before the London bombings, the Joint Intelligence Committee stated in a classified report leaked the following year that There is a clear consensus within the UK extremist community that Iraq is a legitimate jihad and should be supported. Iraq has re-emerged and refocused a wide range of networks in the UK. The conflict in Iraq has exacerbated the threat from international terrorism and will continue to have an impact in the long term. And then later on, it says, giving way to active oppression. The war on terror and in Iraq and Afghanistan are all seen by a section of British Muslims as having been acts against Islam. This double standard has been pointed out by Osama bin Laden in a speech 5 years before 7/7. In 2000, he had said, this is bin Laden, "The British are responsible for destroying the caliphate system. They are the ones who created the Palestinian problem. They are the ones who put the arms embargo on the Muslims of Bosnia so that 2 million Muslims were killed. They are the ones who are starving the Iraqi children, and they are continuously dropping bombs on those innocent Iraqi children." Bin Laden's views had a degree of accuracy about them, far more so than the justifications for the London bombings put forward by the ringleader of the gang, Mohammed Sadiq Khan. Also wanted to backtrack right before that bit, the Pakistani bit ended with, "Yet Pakistan's sponsorship of this terrorist infrastructure in Kashmir did not stop, as we see later, and Whitehall applied no real pressure for it to do so. Rather, it continued to arm, train, and trade with Pakistan. It was Pakistan's policies towards Kashmir and the domestic Islamist groups that combined with the invasion of Iraq in 2003 to help produce the events in London on July 7, 2005. So ongoing mixed baggedness, double standards, forked tongues. Yeah, the ongoing stuff that just exacerbates the problems. And later on, farther on, this section, "Trail of the 7/7 bombers clearly goes back to Pakistan. Khan was trained in northern Pakistan in July 2003, etc., etc., etc." So, so much of this is so good. I want to read more, but I'll be doing this series for longer than I want to do it. And ending that section, "The nexus of terrorist links emanating from the London bombers was very clearly points both to Islamabad and to current and past British foreign policy. Indeed, 7/7 was partly a case of blowback." So again, I'm reminded sometimes in the news, you know, read an article about it's blowback. Well, a lot of times these things are partial because you have a combination of factors going on. And then here's the section after 7/7. "Since the London bombings, most of the known terrorist plots against British targets have also involved Britons of Pakistani origin with links to Pakistan-based groups. British ministers now say that 70% of the terrorism affecting the UK has links to Pakistan. Extremists in Britain continue to be in contact with terrorists based in Pakistan's border areas, from where they get guidance and in some cases training for operations. Yet the British government continued to place great public faith in the Musharraf regime's willingness to confront terrorism right up to its demise. Despite the fact that Pakistan had been sponsoring jihadist groups for the past 3 decades, and despite these groups' links with the 7/7 bombers, the government of Pakistan is a key ally in the efforts we are making to combat extremism, radicalization, and terrorism, both in the UK and overseas," Foreign Office Minister Ian Pearson said a fortnight after the London bombings. "London's adulation for Musharraf's Pakistan was more than matched by U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, who said in mid-2006 that President Musharraf has done an excellent job in a difficult country in a difficult environment and is clearly dedicated to defeating terror. He has shown terrific leadership, courageous leadership, as the U.S. pumped more than $10 billion in aid to Pakistan in the 6 years after 9/11, much of which was military aid." $10 billion after 9/11. And just skipping through here again, another mention of the double standard. "As before, it was not that Britain was unaware of Pakistan's support for terrorism. A report written by a naval commander at the Defense Academy, a think tank for the Ministry of Defense, and leaked to the media in 2006 stated that the Pakistani Army's dual role in combating terrorism and at the same time promoting the MMA, the Coalition of Religious Parties, and so indirectly supporting the Taliban through the ISI, is coming under closer and closer international scrutiny." And there's a mention of Human Rights Watch report. So, you know, recently we have read about some of their questionable practices, same with Amnesty International. But for what it's worth, here's their comment, because it's so loaded. This is Well, this, the phrase constantly bandied about by the British government, enlightened moderation, that's oxymoronic, seemed curiously nebulous, yet Human Rights Watch Pakistani specialists wrote that it was anything but. Enlightened moderation is a hoax perpetrated by Musharraf for the international consumption. What is known in Pakistan as the Mullah Military Alliance remains deeply rooted, and the Pakistani military and Musharraf continue to view moderate and liberal forces in politics and society as their principal adversaries. The reason is simple. Democracy, human rights, and meaningful civil liberties are anathema to a hyper-militarized state. Pakistanis voters consistently vote overwhelmingly for moderate, secular-oriented parties and reject religious extremists, so the military must rely in the most regressive elements on society to preserve its hold on power. The military must rely in the most retrogressive elements on society to preserve its hold on power. A couple of comments there. There's the, you know, very much the U.S. empire, the, you know, the anathema to a hyper-militarized state, and that the people, the common sense of the people, consistently vote for moderate, secular-oriented parties. So, another silver lining to all this bullshit is that, you know, is that generally the people know what's going on and want a more peaceful way. Again, double standard. 4 months later, Musharraf imposed martial law in Pakistan, suspending the constitution and arresting human rights activists and lawyers. The British government reacted by publicly imploring a return to civilian and democratic rule, the usual mantra, but Whitehall threatened no cutoff in aid or military support to the regime. And wrapping up this chapter, 7-7 and the London Islamabad axis, in conclusion, it is certainly ironic that jihadists target Britain for its alleged war on Islam when it has long connived with Islamist forces and their Pakistani state sponsors. To a large extent, the 7-7 and other would-be British bombers and British foreign policy have come out of the same stable. It is the Pakistani terrorist groups that were on 7-7 and continue to be the major terrorist threats to Britain and many other countries. The Western media is focused on bin Laden, yet the Pakistani groups owe little or nothing to Al-Qaeda and have arisen largely separate from it, thanks considerably to the support from the Pakistani state. Britain's longtime support for Islamabad has increased the likelihood of terrorism in Britain. Indeed, this policy is arguably more responsible for threatening Britain than the invasion of Iraq. While appearing to be confronting radical Islam in Pakistan, Britain has again been working in effect with forces allied to it, a policy which has helped marginalize secular, nationalist, and democratic forces within the country. A long-standing priority based on Whitehall's fear of genuine democracy and consistent with the historical record outlined in previous chapters. Chapter 18 is a very interesting Alliances of Moderation. He gets into explaining what that means. In essence, Tony Blair called an Alliance of Moderation in reality part of London's increasing reliance on Sunni forces in the region. So the Alliances of Moderation, again, the kind of double standard mixed bag, which gets to that sort of schizoidness, which I am seeing more and more as I look at politics and cultures, and even why I am once a Walt Whitman enthusiast. Okay, like I appreciate his poetry a lot, and you know, in some ways he was a man of his times. But the phrase that came out of Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's book, Indigenous Peoples' History of the U.S., I think it was called Populist Imperialism. So you have this kind of appealing to nicey-nice good stuff, but yet under the limitation of an imperialist system. So it's, you know, it's like a vicious, depending on your experience, a pleasant or a vicious or rotating circle that you know, maintains it prevents the liberation, true liberation. So anyway, that's my theory, and as they say, I'm sticking with it. So that's it for this show, and the next chapter, like I said before, looks like a few more shows for this series. So thanks for hanging in there with it, and take care. Have a good one.